Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey everyone, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome again to the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. My guest on this week's pod, and indeed next week, because it's a two-parter, is former V8 Supercar privateer and team owner, John Faulkner. Now, there was so much to talk about with JF, we had to split it into two parts. There was no way we could cram it into one. Now, we talked on this first part about a bunch of stuff. We talked about how he bought a one-way ticket to Australia when he was 16 and didn't tell his parents he was going from New Zealand. We talk about how he got into touring car racing, his first Bathurst 1000 start, about giving away car racing and going karting and then coming back to become a factory Toyota driver in their Corolla touring car program in the Group A days. And of course then, how he became one of the stars of the Calder Park Thunderdome in Oscar and NASCAR racing, Super Speedway, really big in Australia in the early to mid-90s, and JF was right among it all. We also hit him up for our new segment, What's in Your Cupboard, to chat about what memorabilia he's kept from along the way from his racing career, courtesy of our friends at the Motorsport Trader. Now, we were supposed to do this one in person. I was supposed to be sitting on the Gold Coast face-to-face across the kitchen table with JF. Unfortunately, Victoria went into lockdown just as I was about to get on the plane a matter of days beforehand going up to Queensland. So instead, we're on the phone line, we're on the landline, but nevertheless, it all worked fine. The chat is the goal, the stories are the star. Doesn't matter about how we did it, we managed to do it in the end. So buckle up, here we go. Time to start part one of John Faulkner on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. Well, I would have liked to have been sitting with you, John Faulkner, right now. Unfortunately, we're on a phone line. It's the best I can do given COVID, and they won't let me out of the state to come and sit in the sunshine with you up in Queensland. First of all, welcome to the V8 Sleuth Podcast. I'm really sorry that our government has not let me come to see you. But anyway, it's good to have you. How are things in your world?
Yeah, all good. I mean, I appreciate the fact that you're going to stay there. We do struggle with some of the Victorians that have come up here and bring all their shit with them. But,
oh, come on. You were one of them. You were one of them. You moved, what, 15 years ago?
Mate, I can't get any closer to the water, so I'm breathing fresh air and staying out of supermarkets. And I'm at that age where apparently I'm vulnerable, so...
What, 23?
Yeah. Yeah, I used to lie about that, didn't we?
Now, I do remember something about that. You did chisel your age Ingle style there for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I got rid of about 4 years. I can't really remember the reason why, but it was something where I wanted to impress someone, and it went on a document and then got transferred blindly by cams, and all of a sudden I was, 4 years younger, so... Wasn't so bad.
Ah, well, it could have been worse. It could have been 4 years older. Not such a bad thing. Hey,
true.
Exactly. Hey, tell me, as a young bloke growing up in New Zealand, what was the thing that hooked you onto cars and racing? What's the first thing that hooked you in?
Well, New Zealand, you got your driver's license at 15, so it was a no-brainer. We weren't pinching cars and borrowing mum and dad's cars and driving on gravel roads and whatever we could do. Didn't really have the television back then, but, we knew about motorsport. I just couldn't see myself staying in New Zealand. Brother was about to marry someone in gumboots and, my mates were, like, getting married at, 17 and 18, and I was about to turn 17 and thought, got a motorbike, going to sell it, going to go to Aussie. Met a bloke at a party, said he, used to go to Bathurst and stuff like that. And told me about Peter Brock. And so, I just sold my motorbike and got a one-way ticket, didn't tell the folks, and arrived in Melbourne in, January the 1st, 1969.
Wow. So they had no idea. You just went, I'm done. I'm gone.
Just said I was going over to meet a bloke that, was going to look after me and show me around and, it'd be a couple of weeks. And, it took about 6 or 7 years before I actually went back.
And did you come?
They tried everything to get me back, but, I was almost an adult. And only problem was I couldn't technically drive over in Australia, but I did, and I just constantly kept getting caught. And I looked like a paper boy driving a car, at that age. And it was just, had a wall full of speeding tickets and noisy exhausts and failing to produce and failing to attend. And a bit of a bad fella at that age.
So, Jay, if it was more a case of you just wanted to get out of New Zealand rather than you had the grand aspirational goal of becoming a racing driver, it was more just, I want to get out and then we'll see what happens after that.
Yeah, didn't know much about motorsport at all, as, television was like it's in the Flintstone days then. I think it's about all we had, Ride Your Imagine or something. We just didn't get motorsport. Occasionally, I'd heard about Chris Amon, he was sort of probably the only notable person that I'd, heard of Jack Brabham. But, we were riding motorbikes and driving cars fast on gravel roads and all thought we were pretty good, but really wasn't until I got to Australia that, and I didn't really carry that passion over here. I just started, working in the automotive industry as much as I could and a couple of jobs here and there until I could get a car, and which ended up being a Holden Ute and full of rust. And we just started going to the motorsport events, Oran Park, Amaru, Bathurst, just became avid followers of it, and hanging over the fence watching Brock and Beachy, and thought, wow, love to do that one day, and never thought ever possible. Never had those big dreams like a lot of guys do. I just, actually how it started, a guy that I was living with bought an XU1, 1971 or whatever it was that came out. Reasonably wealthy Italian dude, and took us out to Calder. It was a car club meeting. It was Richard Davis in there. It was the first time I'd met him. And I had my first drive of a decent car and wound him off and quite a few others, and thought, right, this is the career. So it really started from there.
Yeah. What was the first race car that you actually got your hands on that was yours?
I went shares in the old Kiwi Rupp Anglia, which was a sports sedan back in the late 60s, early 70s, had a mid-mounted Holden in it, paid like $200 for it, had all these dreams of just putting a motor in it. That was the sales pitch, and sat and looked at that for 2 years in a mate's shed in Caulfield, and never went any further than, we just weren't earning the money then, I think I was like $50 a week and, doing as many mechanical jobs as I could of the night and cleaning bloody, commercial buildings of a night and just trying to survive, Wanted to buy a Cortina. That was my first car I actually bought as a road car, GT Mark 1, and sold the Anglia. Built my first race car, which was went halves again in a Capri V6. I bought it off John Mann, a Victorian ex-Mustang racer. Mm. Probably some of the fan base would remember him. He was a good guy, a car salesman. So it was unpainted and been burned out, but it was half restored. So I went halves in that. And, was working at a Shell service station in the Caulfield Racecourse area and had a huge workshop, and they were very kind and let me sort of set up, JFR, I suppose, and in the corner and beaver it away and built that car there.
Am I right in remembering or reading somewhere along the line that the link up that you had with Gary Dumbrell, Paul's dad, You raced at Bathurst and you did some touring car racing together. Did that start because he crashed into you one day out at Calder in, I guess, the late 70s or somewhere around there?
Yeah. Well, in those days, I was, you know, I was driving all sorts of, like I was buying and selling cars and, you know, whatever was quick. I'd sort of run at club events, motor carners, hill climbs. But the Capri was nearing, you know, like it was half reasonable. I had the Webers on it and a bit of a roll cage and some wheels and some mini lights, in fact. And they asked me to do a 6-hour relay race there, local car club. And turned out I was about the only car remaining on the track after 6 hours. And about the other car was happened to be this guy in a mini, which was very fast. And it turned out we're racing for the win, and he was all over me, and obviously, you know, I had more power and he had better corners, and he ended up firing into my door like huge, and we, you know, finished the race. I can't even remember, you know, what club won, but I'm in the pits loading up and I'm pissed off. I got, you know, cars all dented and, you know, it was like a freebie. I'd worn the thing out, done a million laps because all the other cars had shit themselves. And he walks up and he goes, oh, puts his hand out. Going, Umbral, I'd like to pay for that damage. I'm really sorry. I had a great race. I said, oh, shit, you know, fantastic, you know. So he said, you know, here's my number, get in contact with me. And I did. And then he said, what are your thoughts about running at Bathurst? He said, you know, I'd love to do it one day. And I said, mate, that's me. At that time, I think he was the manager of Wins, or his dad was, company was. And, started from there.
So tell me about that. Was it 1980, the first Bathurst that you did in an Escort?
No. Yeah, well, yeah, we tried to enter the Capri for 2 years running. We built it up, fully up to a touring car, and we'd shared, you know, all the Amscar, Amaru, Endurance, you know, Sandown, Hangtin 400s, all those sort of things. But Stibbard and the ARDC just refused. I mean, I think they hated Gary. He'd upset them with something, probably a million phone calls, and they just wouldn't accept the Capri. They were letting, you know, Seaton's old man run one and RX3s and all that crap. And so I had to go out and finance a two-door Escort and flat out built that. That was 1980 with a bit of, that's where I met Ray Cutchy, you know, from the Alan Moffat days. And he steered me in all the right directions to build it quickly. And we got an entry accepted. And, yeah, that was our first Bathurst together. It was Allbrill's Auto Care. He'd bought all the Brian Spee shops by then. And needed, you know, we had Sally's and, you know, had the pit girls and a couple of crew and some uniforms and, you know, a little bit of money, just enough money to, you know, build a car and get there. But, you know, all the work was done entirely by me. He was a guy that wore a suit every day, so there was no help.
Made a combo. One guy does the car, the other guy helps bring the money to make it all happen. So it's been a few combos over
years. Yeah, I mean, that's how most of it starts. Yeah, you find someone with some money. Well, he found me, you know, and I was enthusiastic and, you know, I never said no. And even though I couldn't deliver half the shit that I promised, I built the car and, look, it was as stock as a rock. It didn't even have a diff in it and, you know, there was no close ratio gearbox. But we had a good engine. Cutchy built us, you know, something pretty flash. And it was, it was good.
What do you remember of that first Bathurst? Because I guess that's only a matter of what years since you'd been there as a fan with your chin hanging over the fence.
Just frightened, you know. Honestly, I just, you know, I'd done the Hang 10, like the Sandowns, and I thought, man, that was pretty quick over the top, even in these things. And at that stage, I think they're approaching, you know, I think we had like 180 or 90 horsepower or something, 800 kilo car. Bathurst just, it frankly scared me. It was out of my league, really. I hadn't done a lot of racing with super competitive drivers. So we had a class of, you know, 7 or 8 cars, mainly all Escorts. And, you know, I think it was Peter Williamson who was just flogging everyone because it was up to 2 litre. But, yeah, no, it was it was good. Gary was, he was a good steer, but a little bit slower than me, a bit more conservative, but we just thought we'd plot around, had a you know, pretty wide-eyed about the whole thing, you know. All you got was lies from most of the people you asked, you know, about what gears and what corners.
Well, surely you weren't shocked by that. Come on now.
I wasn't really into making friends in those days, and I was a bit in awe of, you know, your Brocks and your Bartletts and all those dudes. They were hard guys to, you know, get to know because we were class cars and, you know, unless you're running a front-running car, you weren't in that group. The only thing they ever wanted off me was a cigarette, you know, that was about it. There was nothing else, nothing in the communication, nothing in driver's briefings. It was just get in, get out, you know, don't get in the way. Yep. They'd come down and tell you off if you didn't move over quick enough, and in those days, moving over was the thing to do. But I learned a lot. It was good. You know, learn it was all about preparation. Didn't have to be a great driver to, you know, to finish Bathurst.
Mm. So at this stage, mate, what are you doing? Are you full-time on working on this race car, working the service station? What are you doing?
I'm just trying to make money, pressure to buy a house, you know, start a family, working long hours. I probably had more clients than the people I was working for. They were so good to me, the goal of a family, and was right opposite the Caulfield race course. So I get the odd tip off the jockeys and trainers, and which all went into the cash can, and you know, just try to develop the car. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, got a Cologne engine, the same engine that, you know, your Rod Stevens and your Browns were running, and, you know, the cars that were winning, we needed that sort of gear. So we got the diff, got the right gearbox, and all of a sudden I'm front row Joe, you know, up under 2 litre at Cola, and, you know, it all started to work for us. But no money, you know, Dunbar was, unless he was getting a seat, there was no money.
Mm.
So we only had endurance stuff. And my partner in it, who I was working with, unfortunately died in a car testing accident. He worked for a local Ford dealer, and he was like my best mate and one that helped me work all night on cars. And yeah, when he passed, it was I got a bit disillusioned with it, parked it in the corner, put it up for sale and bought a house, and went right up, got a house. So now I'll go go-karting, I think. I've been to a couple of local meetings and was impressed with them, and so waddled into Drew Price Engineering and had one with a, you know, ordered one with a lot, the best you could buy then, which was a DAP, you know, engine and wets and frame, and the whole lot was about $3,000. It was awesome.
Far cheaper than believe car it. Racing.
I couldn't spend enough, you know. It was just amazing. And by that stage, I'd moved into an Ampol petrol station, which had a good workshop, and I was leasing that, and that was just up the road from DPE, and so yeah, it was that's how it started. Just disillusioned with the motorsport, never thought I'd ever get a decent car to run there. And anyway, about a year later, I got a phone call off the guy that bought my Escort and said, yeah, he'd on sold it. I never got a start at Bathurst in it. He'd bought the Colin Bond Masters and Holmes Capri, which was, you know, really nicely built Sydney car. They were fast. Asked me to run it at one of the Adelaide ATCC rounds. So, yeah, drove over there, jumped in that, and that was my first race car. That was something that was pretty special. You know, I thought, well, you know, this is what one should feel like. Gave me the bug again. That was, I think, 1983. That was just a one-off, though. So back to go-karts, loved it. Racing everywhere, country series. Didn't do many Australian titles. That bored me, you know, like 300 or 400 go-karters all in the pits for 3 days, and you know, you get one, you're punted and you're out, you know. So
yeah.
I didn't really chase championships. It was just all about wins for me.
And who was racing? Who was in that era of karting that our listeners might know of?
Well, adults, there was, Drew Price was like, yeah, as he was known as God, he did won like Australian title 6 times. It was John Pizarro. Ingalls come along, but later, he was a junior when I was running. Howard Heath, you know, Hollier, not really, not many of them went on to motorsport in those days. They sort of stuck with their own. They're a bit like Speedway, you know, they stuck together. The Price family, obviously. David Price was running then, but no one that I later on went on to in you know, touring cars or supercars or Bathurst and stuff like that. Yeah. Ingalls pissed off to England and sort of even forgot about him. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, I'm at Bathurst one day and, you know, I'm up over the top and I look in the rear vision mirror and it's bloody Ingalls in that GIO car. And he gives me a belt in the rear because we had some bad blood at that time. And
oh, really? From the karting days? Or?
Oh, yeah, shit. Yeah, yeah. I just sent him down the road a couple of times and he did the same to me. And it was a bit of a team thing. He drove for Drew Price's opposition and I quite often drove mostly Drew's products. And then I was a bit of a mole. I switched to Swiss Huttless, another brand that Ritter was bringing in, and he bought this car at the World Championships and basically bought it straight off the grid, tyres and all, lifted it up, as you do buy something, you know, that's just one. Took it back to Australia and rang me and said, JF, I got this cart and, you know, it's one off and can you run it the Vic title? So I said, yeah, I'm there, you know. So I put it on pole. I think won the first race and then turned out that, you know, it ended up Drew, Ingalls, me and I think Pizarro for the win type deal. And I wasn't on pole. I'd missed one heat, a chain had broke or something. So I remember getting the nod from, I can't remember whether it was Drew, I think it was Drew or his dad said, here's your big chance, JF. So I lined up Ingalls and sent him down the road and on the opening lap. And we won the team event. And, yeah, there was a huge argument. There was almost a fist fight. I had Buddy Ritter pulling us off and pushing and grabbing and holding. And, yeah, it was a pretty shitty deal. And then he pretty much went to Europe, so didn't have to deal with him. But eventually, you know, we all caught up, we're mates again, and he was in and out of drives and, good times.
Yeah.
Good times. I always knew he'd go somewhere. He was such a good steer in karts. When he became an adult in karts, he was, you know, one track mind, you know, win at all costs. And that was my style as well.
Mm. Oh, well, you probably, even though you butted heads, you were of the same viewpoint and the same style and the same way of approach to it. So there's a respect there between. Too hard.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'd call it respect.
His
driving style was so unique, and you know, I quite often, you know, I admired watching him in other classes, and as well as your John Pizarro's, Drew Price was just polished and you know, absolutely brilliant in a kart. But you know, none of them were unbeatable. I could beat all of them on my day. I was ruthless, you know. A couple of taps, and if you didn't move, you're out. You know, I had no tolerance for blocking. You know, in karting, you just, as soon as you got to someone, you had to pass them. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else you could do.
Hey, another thing I forgot about that I wanted to quickly ask you about too. So your first, we'll talk about Oscar, NASCAR, V8 supercar. So cars with V8 engines became a regular thing for you later in your career. But your first Bathurst in a V8 wasn't in a supercar. It was actually in a Group C Commodore in the last year of Group C, that yellow Colin Campbell V8 Commodore. Yep. That was the old Alan Jones Warren Cullen car, I think. How did that come to be? So I guess the Capri drive that you talked about in 83 sort of helped to lead you back, and the bugs there, you're doing karting. How does another crack at Bathurst in a Commodore pop up?
Yeah, so that was 84. Walking through the pits at Sandown, you know, I'm carless. I'm loving go-karting, and I was getting a bit of a reputation. You know, a lot of guys had, you know, used to go to Oakley and Brooklyn and the Castrol at Oran Park, and you know, I was certainly in that elite bunch of Interlite drivers that had a half a reputation. And I was walking through the pits at Sandown, and Colin Campbell, who used to race a Capri, the Ranger truck rental car, said, "Hey, JF, you know, what are you doing? What are your plans?" And I said, "Look, nothing, mate. I can't afford motorsport, can't afford a built car." He said, "Oh, I've got a group of guys that have bought this car. They own a wrecking yard and a hotel, and they've got enough money to get this car. We've got the car. How would you like to come and, you know, have a run at Bathurst?" And I think they more needed my, you know, licensed acceptance, because Bathurst was like, you know, it was Ivan Stibbard, ARDC, you know, you got an invitation or you didn't go, you know, you could enter, but it didn't necessarily mean you were going to get an entry. So they put my name on the list, and, yeah, we got accepted. Went and had a look at the car, go over a couple of nights, did a few things that I, you know, knew needed to be done to it, knew its history. It looked like it was pretty well built, and what I didn't realise is it didn't have an engine, it had a dog, and you know, we got the sand down in it. There's it was a lead up to Bathurst then, and it was just slow, you know, brakes and cornering, we were both okay, and just up every straight, we were just getting past one either side, and got to Bathurst, and, you know, a couple of seconds a lap at Sandown turned into like 6 and 7 seconds at Bathurst. It was embarrassing. So, yeah, I was pretty disappointed about the whole deal, and but everyone on the team was great, some good guys working on it, and you know, there was nothing we can do. We had no spares, no spare engine. And in the end, you know, the sponsors were going, "Well, you know, why?" And I dragged a lap out of it just to get, you know, into qualifying, which was still 6 seconds off. You know, my mate, Steve Harrington, who was running, I think, the SDP car or one of those brands, he was giving me advice. And I said, "Look, I'm just down on speed. I think I'm good everywhere else." And so the sponsors all, you know, over dinner that night, we you know, this was on, I think, on a Thursday or Friday, we were nowhere, and they come up with an idea, "Well, how about we lease you an engine? We'll go and talk to HR or HDT or Larry Perkins, whoever was running it then." So they did that, and Larry came up, looked at the car and said, yep, it'll go straight in. And so we leased this engine. You know, it was like we'd already qualified. So it was like, would have been Saturday we were bolting the thing in. And then Larry came up in the white overalls and leaned over and screwed a couple of jets into the Webers and had a pair of shocks under his arm. Because I said the thing, not only was it dangerous, it was like a pogo stick, you know, it was just, you'd go through the dip and you were still bouncing at McPhillamy Park. And so a couple of Bilsteins went in the front, we give it a rough tow, got the thing fired up. I got out for the warm-up, and my third lap, I think, I did a 19, which was like sixth fastest Commodore. So 6 seconds at least.
The straights get a bit shorter when you get a bit more grunt.
Oh, it was, I thought, and the handling was just, it transformed the whole car. It made it really good to drive. So other than we broke a Watts linkage bolt, car was fine. You know, we pressed on with that, and it just got too dangerous to drive. We put a socket and a bolt and something else that didn't fit, and the wheel, the only thing holding the wheels in were the guards, and yeah. Colin, the other driver, just refused to drive it. So I'd done the maximum laps. We had to park it. You know, I can't even remember whether we finished. It was scary. I know that.
That's the bit that stands out. Not the result. It's just that it was scary and it was all over.
Well, yeah, and the fact that there were engines out there and suspension and guys that knew what they were doing. It was like driving the Bond Masterton car. It was brilliant to drive. It just did everything right. And so straight after Bathurst, it was like the Colden meeting, and as Colin was the one who put the deal together and the lead driver, I felt really sorry that they asked me to drive it at Calder, you know, in a sprint race.
Which was the Australian Grand Prix support race at the end of that
year. Yeah. So I've lined up there, and of course, no money again. Lowry's wants his engine back like the following week. He said, all right, I'll let you do Calder because you didn't do many kilometres at Bathurst. And that, you know, all that typical Lowry deal. And we kept the shocks. And so, yeah, I dropped it on the grid there and found myself, you know, looking to drive around the outside of Harvey in the opening laps and pushing for the top five. You know, I thought, wow, this is what I want to do. Mm. You know, that in those days it was Glow Weave and it was a short track and a bit of Biff and Barge. But, I still had the same tyres on that had done, I think, a double stint at Bathurst. And, you know, basically wound all of them off and four or five laps and I was a couple of seconds back from the bunch and that's where I stayed.
Yeah.
Couldn't do much with it.
And I guess then that, mate, that leads to that point of great opportunity, got to do Sandown, got to do Bathurst, but then what? We're back to kind of where we started, or did the Toyota thing start to bubble from there?
What really started it was a test drive of the Roadways Harrington stuff. They invited me out. Garth Wigston, I think, was going to retire, which I think he said every year, and Stevie Joe was, I was racing carts at his kart shop, flying in and out of Tassie. And in those days, you could win money and go karts. It was on TV, you know, it was quite a good sport. And I don't think it was Les Small, but it was another guy running Roadways at the time. So I went out to Calder and I did a test session there with them and, well, never got the drive. Apparently I was too quick, so a few noses out of joint. Never got the call up. We remained mates. And I just, you know, went on the merry way and back to karting again. And it was about 85, I think, Tony Niovani, who's daughter raced karts and, you know, was a well-credentialed driver in himself. I'd heard about his career in HDT and driving lots of different cars and Bathurst. And he approached me at the karts and said, look, there's an opportunity to test a Works Corolla for Toyota Team Australia at Winton. Are you interested? And I thought, that's me. And it was a fairly big meeting we were at Oakley, and what I didn't know, he had also asked Drew and, you know, maybe a couple of others. I wasn't sure. I didn't ask too many questions. I said, yep, love to, you know, Winton test day, fantastic. And then proceeded to have the worst day in karts in front of him. Like, I punted everybody. I punted Drew off. It was just shocking. And never got the call up. Never even got to turn up at Winton with your helmet. Nothing. I don't know what I did wrong. I have no idea. I had heaps of pace and, you know, but I was a guy that entered three classes at every meeting. You know, I just couldn't get enough racing. So I'd be bolting lead on and lead off and two carts. And anyway, it didn't happen. I didn't bother asking. I just pressed on. And then I got a phone call off Ray Cutchie. Said, hey, I've got the factory car. They've asked me to prep it and run it at Sandown and Bathurst. I'd like you to come and drive with me. And my only relationship with Ray was I'd have lunch down there 3 days a week. I'd drive from Caulfield to Moorabbin, his shop's not far from Larry's, and I'd either buy him lunch or we'd just chat about, you know, the Moffat days. And you know, I learned so much off him, how to use his lathe and setups, and used to help him as much as I could over that hour over lunch. I was always late back to work. And, so he just... He had the car down there and all the help and components we needed, and I didn't have any hand in it whatsoever. Ray did everything himself and everything was immaculate. It was just, you know, I just knew we were going to have a really, really good, strong car. And it was the first of the A86 hatchbacks. So it was the one that Smithy had run in 84, pretty much on his own against, you know, Bob Holden and a few others. But they'd got a brand new car, and Drew was the one that went to the test. The prick never told me that he did. So I found out the hard way, and I was really pissed off. because Drew had also had a camp license and had raced escorts and minis and stuff. He was a quite conservative guy and we were good mates. And, you know, I know it must have been hard for him to, you know, not tell me about it. And anyway, it all turned out good in the end. And me and Ray fronted at Sandown and, yeah, we were part of the team. You know, we had the full crew and everyone had a uniform. We all had a shiny new driving suit. And it was my first real opportunity to meet John Smith, who I'd seen in open wheelers and stuff like that. And he was super competitive and it was all about John Smith, the whole team, but Drew was just sort of there to, you know, fill in like I was, apparently. But, yeah, we had a good run and the car went great. We won. Their car fell over and that was our first win together, me and Ray. So got the big trophy and looked forward to heading to Bathurst. So it was just the start of our, well, my TTA program. I wasn't an official driver then. It was just, you know, here I was entered under TTA but wasn't getting paid for it. That came later. So, yeah.
Look forward to it. It became such a big part of that Group A touring car era, JF. The TTA cars, yourself, Mike Quinn's there for a bit, Smithy, of course, Drew. And then they gave other drivers opportunities later on down the track, Brooke Tatnall, all sorts of people. But, I mean, Toyota stuck up. I mean, they're involved in the game now with the 86 series, which is great. Being a class competitor, I mean, occasionally there'd be a rival pop up. The Nissan Gazelle's one of the cars that springs to mind, but it was generally class Corolla. Was it fun having your own domain, battling one another, or did you get to the point where it's good? But, I mean, you were there for, what, 4 or 5 years? I think that TTA program, you were part of that. Two wins at Bathurst in 86 and 88. But after a while, I guess it gets a bit frustrating because you kind of see these guys lapping you every 10 laps going, I want to be one of them. This is nice. I'm getting paid to do this, but I kind of want to have a go in one of those.
Yeah, you did right. All of that, that's it was mind games. It got to the point, well, I won't go into that just yet, but it was very much, the team was pretty much run by Smithy, and he was a Sydney Toyota dealer, family dealership. The Toyota marketing department was all in Sydney. They all wanted it in Sydney, but it was based in Port Melbourne. And Niavani was doing like paint identification or something, and someone said, hey, you know, who knows anything about motor racing? Oh, Niavani. So like he was our manager and a good fit. So he got a good group of guys together. The workshop, race shop was immaculate. The cars pretty much came from TRD or Tom's in Japan. You just took the ribbon off, put the petrol in, and away you went. We didn't have to do much at all. You know, we took out the 1,200-pound springs and put in 600 pounds so we could use the curbs, and we drove them. But when you were racing against other Corollas, they were brilliant. They had like 200 horsepower, 800 kilos. I mean, you know, crash box, fast, well put together. You couldn't break them. They revved to, you know, 8,800, 9,000 in qualifying. Engines were bulletproof, but you were always in your mirrors with the other cars. It was class cars. Most of the BMs were way quicker. Some of the older ones, we were faster then. But in those days, we were racing against Sierras and you know, bloody Volvos and all sorts of other crap. And the Sierras had worn the tyres off, and after, you know, 10 or 15 laps, you were almost at their pace. Like, they were in your way under brakes, around the mid-corners. They had no corner speed, but then they'd blaze off down the straight. So in the end, we were just chasing, back running Sierras, BMs, you know, slow Commodores, guys that, you know, stumbled over a few grand and bought a, you know, an ex Group C car or something. But places like Amaroo, where we were super competitive, and whenever it rained, we were right there. I remember being I think, third in one of the sessions at the World Touring Car Championship in the wet, you know, around Thunderdome, me and Drew, in the front-wheel drive. Like, it was just amazingly fast. And another time, I was sixth on the grid at Amaru alongside in front of Wyn Percy in the Holden Racing Team car in the rain. And I remember at the media, he said, gee, I used to drive those things, but I didn't think they were that quick, you know. So we had Crompton gave us a wrap at Bathurst. You know, no one could pass us from Skyline down to Forest Elbow. We were, that was our, you know, you could just drive them on the limit. But nothing up or down the hill. We were just, you know, fixed speed, and that was it. Our only real competition came when the British car came out. The Hodgesters one that won everything in Europe. It actually won the British Touring Car Championship by winning its class every round. It beat, you know, Sierras and Rovers, and they came out well credentialed with a flat out cheater at Bathurst, and we got all excited. And they were very fast, but I think we managed to beat them in the end, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think
can't really remember.
That was the World Championship year, and that's the year it rained, and the two, probably the worst race outcome for TTA, both the cars leading the class smacked the fence at the top of the hill and were out in the rain. And Bob Holden ended up wandering along. I think he was about eight laps behind you at the time. He ended up winning the class with Gary Wilmington in his car. So,
that's it. That was 87 when
were you in one of those cars?
I just got out of the car. Smithy had just got out of the car and two pit stops in a row. And, you know, I was just looking at the TV and saw it all happen. You know, the Rivers weren't there when I got out, and Drew and, Quinny, I think it was Quinny in my car. No, who was it? Can't even remember.
Yeah, I think it might have been. I think it was.
Yeah. It destroyed, and like there wasn't that much damage, but then, you know, half a dozen other cars came around and slammed into them, and it was the end of it. I think mine ended up in the Bathurst Museum for years. And
still there. And, it is still there.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the others, you know, we were offered the cars when Toyota finally quit for a dollar, providing we raced them. Smithy took the Supra to Sydney. Me and Drew were offered a car each, but they wanted us to run them, you know, and we knew that, you know, an engine was 20 grand and we weren't spending that sort of money. And to be honest, we were looking for excuses not to even run them at, like, Amaru. We were racing nearly every second weekend. If we weren't doing the AMSCAR series, we were doing the Australian Touring Car series. We were doing ride days, all the dealerships all around the country. That was fun. Good meeting all those people. We were on, I think it was about $1,000 a win. Got a bit of Dunlop prize money, company car. You know, like in those days, there was very few people paid to drive. We always, you know, paid to perform prior to that. So as much as it was income producing, and I mean, there was lots of envious guys that would love to have taken our spot, but it did get a bit boring in the end. We were racing basically against ourselves. Bob had a few rented drivers, but we had always had new tyres. We never rolled out with anything shit. It was always brand new and fast and, you know, just good.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
Along the way there, mate, the competition was pretty high internally because you guys were the pace-setting cars of the time in that under 2 litre class era. But tell me about one of the ones I wanted to cover off with you was in 88, you and Drew won the small car class, and you finished 9th overall at Bathurst, or 10th. It was at the tail of the top 10, which didn't happen very often. If you had a good run, you were kind of in the mid-teens or the the late teens overall. But do you remember that one? Because that's a stunning – no one will ever do anything like that ever again, to finish in the top 10 in a – I mean, we don't have classes anymore, which is a whole other story, but that's just about got to be the standout result from that period, surely.
Yeah, it was. It was a good thing. But how that happened, the front-wheel drive car, the hatches, they were – you know, like pigs, the understeer and torque steer, and like they went like rocket ships, and they were bulletproof reliable, but they were just difficult to drive. And the rear wheel drive that Smithy was running would, you know, he'd be way ahead at the end of most sprint races. And then the new front wheel drives came in the 92, and they were damn fast and almost comparable to the rear wheel drive. But in 88, Niavani said, look, I think Smithy had ran off and got a Sierra drive with Johnson, and Drew was being looked at with Seaton on some opportunities. And Niavani said, look, you and John together, it was our first time really. We'll get a hot rod engine. We'll do the best we can. I think we took it to Les Small and tried to tweak it up a bit, and we had the latest Dunlop tyres, and you know, the thing was just fully fruited up, and they upped the rev limit for us, and he said, just, we want you to drive it flat out, you know, to see what you can do. So we did all the right pit stops. We just, you know, every lap was almost a qualifier. Both of us had equal pace. Qualifying, Drew was such a layback dude, like, you know, Niavani go, right, qualifying's up, who's qualifying? Drew go, oh, you know, I don't care. Do you want to? And I said, oh, no, you can do it, you know. Like, it just didn't matter. We were real teammates. It was really, really good. And we pushed and flogged and banged and ended up, you know, I think we were top 10, and then, you know, I think the Sierras or something was scrubbed, and then we went to ninth, and then someone else got thrown out. I might have been and officially ended up eighth. But it was a lot of laps and a great result, and you know, Toyota were ecstatic then, but they didn't really promote it that well because it was rear wheel drive and you couldn't buy it. And they were really pushing the front wheel drives, which I then went on to. Drew moved on to other things, and Smithy went in other directions, and they left the front wheel drives pretty much to me. Then I had it on my own for a couple of years, and so they bought that. You know, where you said, Speedway guy, search for a crash. That was the
that's what they called terminology. It. Is that what you called it internally?
Well, yeah,
I think it was search for a star. I think it was technically that's officially,
it. Yeah.
Officially.
Yeah, I remember we were given a list at a debrief, and I went, what? You know, and all these names, and I thought, they're going to bin this thing. I mean, they're hard to drive. You know, crash box and no power steer and heavy brakes and. You know, you only got to touch a curb and you'd two-wheel the thing, you'd bicycle it for the next 50 metres. They were dangerous, hard to drive, you know, right at the very end of the rev limit. And if you weren't in that 7.5 to 8.8, it was a pig, no talk. And we had, like, Terry Sawyer, I remember her, this Oscar.
Yep. Brooke Tappan had a run, I remember.
Speedway guy, yeah.
Michael Dowson, the motorcycle racer who ended up driving at Bathurst with Neil Bates. Brilliant. He was fast.
Bates was fast. We had another dude in Perth, just a club racer dude, the Fogs, or whatever his name
was. Anthony Fogliani.
That's him. He was great. Look, they were all good. Limited practice. I was straight in at the deep end. And, we had bloody Bondi and, you know, Longhurst coming up, shaking fists at us. You know, why you stick these wankers in the cars? You know, everyone's getting in the way and, you know, they just didn't have any motor racing experience, and here they were, you know, in a full field of ATCC cars, guys that were earning a living out of it, and I was meant to coach them. It was hard, but it was a good program. It got a lot of recognition for them, and in the end, everyone gave us a fair run with it. Good effort. No real major damage. I sent Dowson down the road. He had legs fired. He was probably the fastest. Him and Bates are pretty good.
Well, I think they ended up driving together at Bathurst and won the
they did.
The class
yeah,
that
we
year,
we paired them. Yeah, we paired them, and they gave me Peter McKay, and you know they you know we had a fan bill go, but they smoked us and won their class, so it was good. But
so at this time, JF, were you working in other? Was the Toyota thing a full time job and financial, or was it a case of you still had a day job and this was kind of the nice on the side weekend thing?
I had the petrol station with a three bay shop and chatty there, Ampol, and on the freeway. And look, my Toyota customers, I was doing, you know, a lot of client and fleet work, and had a heap of guys with Supras, Corollas, Sleekers, big following of guys that wanted them tuned up, and, you know, just me, a bit of advice. And you know, we used to have the front wheel drive parked out the front because no one used that anymore, and occasionally I'd give them a lap. I lap down the freeway in the tall Group A thing.
What?
The ones I really knew, you know, like decent enthusiasts.
I hope the constabulary didn't see any of this.
It was pretty special, I tell you. It was really good. And had a good following with him. And yeah, I was earning some good coin out of that. But my aim was, you know, the writing was on the wall that it was going to finish in the end of 90, early 91. Japan had withdrawn their budget because at the time Japan was paying for pretty much all of it. Toyota Australia didn't put a lot of money into it whatsoever, more so the marketing side of it. And I started a shop down in Oakley, which was actually rented out of Drew Price's shop, and I was looking at doing, you know, Oscar NASCAR. So I had my last race at Sandown in a Bob Holden Corolla when Toyota shut the door within like a week.
Wow.
You know, it was just bang, slam. The Sydney guys came up in a truck and raped the joint. Like, there was motors going out the back door and cars and Smithy's loading, pushing everything you can into a truck. Bob Holden's there. There's just a whole lot of magpies and a whole lot of gear on the floor. And it was, as I said, me and Drew were offered a car each, but, you know, what were we going to do with them? You know, we weren't allowed to sell them. We had to race them. And to be honest, we were just a bit over it. I wish now, in hindsight, I had it, knowing what they're worth now. Smithy's still got the Supra.
He does, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I caught up with him at the 50-year reunion and had a good old chat. But, yeah, he still has that. I did get to drive that once when he didn't turn up at Tassie, and that was a very fast car, just a, you know, a big pig to drive.
Just
but
way too
a
heavy,
lot
though.
Of power.
A lot of power, but a lot of weight too.
Yeah, huge. So that was my first drive of that in Tassie, pre-qualifying, and I knew what he was up against, you know, extremely fast, but just too heavy and too hard on the brakes. And, you know, five laps in, you'd worn all the, you know, the tyres off it and the brakes were had it, and, you know, you were dialing the boost down. And, yeah, I knew what he was up against. And, of course, when he entered for Bathurst, you know, I knew half those dudes weren't even going to get a suit, you know, get a lap.
Mm.
It just wasn't reliable either.
Mm.
So it was funny when we first got it. It came in a container from Europe, not Japan, and it was meant to be a shiny new car, and we rolled it out. Had all the, you know, the top brass of Toyota there in the suits, and of course they got it up on jack stands and we're giving it a run and a bit of a rev, and one of our engineers is in it and he's got his foot on the brake and he's boosting the thing up and boosting it up, and everyone's getting more and more excited, and all of a sudden the front left guard blew completely off the car. It exploded. They hadn't, they took the breather up to a 5-litre can under the front guard, which was its overflow, and hadn't drilled a relief hole in it. It pumped up like a balloon till it blew the guard off. And, yeah, that didn't go down too well with the hierarchy. And it was a car we had to have. They didn't want to run it, but we just had to run it. They were selling Supras, and that was about it. So that was our last hurrah, really. And they shut the door, and, you know, we all moved on.
Yeah, and the next chapter went oval track racing. But before we cover that off, we've got a little segment that we like to call What's in Your Cupboard, and it's with thanks to our mates at the motorsporttrader.com. They're the place online that you should head to keep motorsport memories alive. They've got an amazing range of memorabilia. There's panels, there's wheels, there's all sorts of stuff from all sorts of cars over the years. Last time I checked, they had a couple of your old JFR supercar bonnets, including the American Dynapack liveried bonnet from about 2001. So if you're into your memorabilia, go to themotorsporttrader.com. But, JF, what's in your cupboard? What have you kept from over the years? Did you keep your Toyota suits, or have you kept helmets? Have you kept bits from cars? What have you kept from over the journey of racing?
I did have a lot, but because we were in a little townhouse on the water up here, I don't have the storage, and it was only just probably 3 or 4 weeks ago I put a post up on, I think it was on Shitbook. I was actually at the tip throwing out 3 or 4 helmets. Oh. I got all these guys, you know, private messaging me, oh, you know, I'll buy them, I'll buy this and I'll buy that. Mate, I got a wheel nut off a Group A. I had a wheel off a Toyota. I got my original Toyota helmet with radio, whole lot of old helmets. I wasn't a helmet guy, you know. I opened face so I could still smoke with them, you know. Like, it was just, I never really kept. I've got a few suits and shirts and shit like that that Allison's, you know, vacuum bag, and then the dog ate all the zips off them, and, you know, like, it's just, I'm not really into it, to be honest. I got a massive amount of photos and professional stuff. There's no shrine in our house. I've got a couple of model cars, a few old trophies, and nothing really. I'm a garage full of helmets and, yeah, just odd knick-knacks, you know.
That's nothing, all right. Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing that'd be worth any money, although I did find some HRT stuff with Beth, and, you know, I posted that up, and that went straight away. So that was, I found an old couple of, remember the old carbon briefcases? I still found that, the sensitive one.
Yeah.
Everyone used to walk around with a briefcase in those days, and found 3 of them with Seiko digital watches and lap and super licenses and a whole lot of stuff.
Cool.
That we never really needed, but
yeah,
I've still got a lot of stickers, you know.
Yeah, cool. Cool. It's from part of the journey.
But, you know, when I'm gone, it'll be on the nature strip, mate. You know,
there'll be people driving around the Gold Coast keeping an eye, just to know what might end up at the front of JF's house. You touched on it before. Obviously, the TTA era ended at the end of 1990, so it was a great stint there, but obviously it had run its course. And in the meantime, in the late 80s, the Thunderdome got up and rolling. Bob Jane sunk a lot of money out at Calder Park to get that tri-oval put together. NASCAR fired up. OSCAR, the local version with Commodores and Falcons, got rolling. And the fields of OSCAR particularly grew very quickly. Were you kind of at the end of the Toyota era going, I'm out of racing again, I haven't got a thing, or you'd already identified that OSCAR thing, that's where I want to go. The prize money's good. It's on telly. I can get a car cheap. That's my next thing. Had you already identified that as your next step?
Yeah, you're pretty much spot on, Aaron. I Harrington was you know, great mates. We did everything. He lived at my joint when he came back from Europe, and he was, you know, he had a car that Les Small and them had built, and he was, you know, sort of half running there with a sponsored NASCAR as well. And I was still on the fringes of Toyota. We'd done a 24-hour a run at the Thunderdome, you know, to break the world record, which we did.
With road car. So we had like a road car thing.
So yeah. We just went round and round and round and round. So I felt like really intimate with the Thunderdome. Like I knew every bump and crevice on it after 24 hours of running there. And we broke all these records. And I thought, gee, you know, another friend of mine with a workshop up the road, Stafford McLaughlin, he was building a car and he asked for a bit of help. And so I sort of hung around with him a bit. Steve was pretty well organised with Les Small and didn't really need me. And I had a drive of Stafford's car and I was like way quicker than him and a few others. And then Stevie said to me, oh, look, you know, I've got this new car they want me to run, a VN. Do you want to run my old VL? You know, I'm like, we'll do a cheap lease deal. It's good prize money, you know. And I said, yeah, look, that's me, you know. So straight in at the deep end. The car was there, a couple of Les's guys, Ricky Rush and another dude. Just as a bit of a crew, motley crew sort of thing. No new tyres, go and have a run, you know, and I think I was like fourth fastest, you know, first run out. Thought, shit, this is pretty easy, and I wasn't really pushing it. And I was actually a bit quicker than Steve in the VN. And so anyway, we get into qualifying, and yeah, it was all good. I think I qualified in the top four or five and start the race, and I didn't realise that they all ran around and, you know, played with each other until 10 laps to go and then there was a race. You know, I'd seen Days of Thunder and come out of that with a tear in my eye and thought, you know.
Prerequisite for any super speedway driver.
Yeah. Look, it honestly got me motivated to want to do that. And I thought, but the biggest motivating factor was the prize money.
Mm.
It was something like 25 grand for a win.
That's a race win, not a championship win. Yeah. That was every time you ran out.
Yeah, turn up and run. And so here I am in a car that, you know, the engine felt really good, had some pretty cluey guys on it, you know, turn here, turn there, as they say, and it turned it into a jet for the race. And I put an in-car camera in it that I had lying around from the old days, and we started the race and it just came to me within four or five laps. I was challenging Brad for the lead. And I'm thinking, this is just too easy, you know. Like, there was no finger and there was no waving me by. And we were close and, you know, we were a touch here and a touch there and all grouped. And I thought, oh, no, bugger it. I'm going to take the lead. So I just, you know, fired into the lead, led it for a little bit, you know, realised quickly that I think they were all playing with me a little bit. You know, they were a conservative pace, but, you know, they weren't really pushing too hard, and I was off. My thing was so loose, I was oversteering it in nearly every lap from lap one, but I had never told anyone. I just thought that's what they did. And eventually it just caught me out. I had my own crash, looped it in front of the whole field. Went up, whacked the wall, and paroled Bruce Williams in the Bendix car, slammed straight into the
that
side of me.
That was a big hit.
Yeah, huge. And I saw it coming. Like I was, because when I spun, the whole thing filled up with smoke, and you know, you can't see what's happening or where you are, and the banking was 23 degrees, and you couldn't even get out of the car, you know, and there were cars. Well, he just slammed into me and he had a, you know, huge crash. It was all totally all my fault. That's just what happened. That was at the end of that car and probably the end of Bruce's. And I went to get out of the car and I remember nearly falling, rolling down the track. Bruce slid down on his bum, I think, from memory. You know, bloody coolant and oil everywhere. And yeah, huge crash. That was the end of it. I knew what was coming, and that was, you know, I was going to have to buy the car.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You bend it, you pay for it.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, that was the end of that race. It was the start of your super speedway era, not just Oscar racing, but you did NASCAR as well. Sometimes you did both for a period there. What was your we talked about the prize money, because that's one of the elements that made it so strong, because it was so appealing. But the coverage when you started early 90s was on Channel 7. Mike Raymond was obviously a huge supporter, not just of touring cars, but he was a big believer in Bob Jane and American-style racing and the Thunderdome. And then after a couple of years, the TV swapped to SBS. And although there was solid amount of coverage and it was well presented, it wasn't on a commercial network. And that's probably where the Oscar NASCAR thing started to unravel a bit. But just tell us a bit more, mate, about driving around the Thunderdome. When you'd already done the World Touring Car Race there, so you had a little bit of an idea in a Corolla what it was like. But for those listening, the concept of going to a bank track like that is completely different from circuit racing. How can you remember it? What was your impression? Was it imposing? What was your take on the whole concept of going round and round on a big bank?
Oh, amazing. The first thing I did, I remember I met up with Marshall Brewer, who I knew from, you know, doing hill climbs in the old days, and he said, come with me, you know. So I went and sat in one of his passenger cars, and we just slowly drove around the track, and then he stopped in turn one on the banking. So as we're rolling, you get the indication of, you know, you're leaning into the corner. And then he stopped the car, and I couldn't believe it. I nearly fell into his lap from the passenger seat. It was just, the banking is 23 degrees. It's just, and when you stop a car, that's when you realise, man, you know, like if you were in a road car, you'd think you're about to roll over. He said, right, it's all centrifugal. And he said, we can go around this, and you're going to average about 200 kilometres an hour, even in an Oscar. Every lap, you're never below about 200, and you're 220 or 230 on the straights. He said it's all centrifugal, so therefore it's like spin around a teacup, you know. And if you flick out, you can't save it. You're wasting your time. You're going to hit something. You're going to hit the wall, or 20 other blokes are going to crash into you. So he gave me a really scary insight into what could happen. And then I went out and did exactly that. You know, I just made a complete cock of it. And it honestly set me back a long way. I had to take that car and, you know, I actually rented a small spot at the back of Perkins's workshop with Harrington, and I think it was Peter Behag there, and there was, Jeff Gretsch and John Stevens. They were all... Larry had wound down. There's all Brock shit there, Sierras and cans of mobile oil. And, you know, everyone was low key, but we were flat out building a new car to replace what I'd, you know, crashed. But I was constantly going out there midweek. I was trying to get as many laps in as many cars as I could, even road stuff, just to try and get that scary feeling out of my system. I didn't think I was going to come to grips with it. A lot of talks with Stevie Joe on you know, he was very successful there, and just said, look, you'll get a groove, you'll find, you know, the right line, drafting, all that sort of stuff. But the biggest thing he taught me, and he was the one that told me to do it, he said, right, we went out there on a couple of test days, and he said, just stay off the brake pedal. Don't touch the brake pedal. He said, your lap times will be just about as fast. He said, but you'll learn to roll off the throttle. He said, because it's the brakes that get you into trouble. He said, you get in there that quick, you tend to overbrake them, and that's when the weight transfer happens. And so, yeah, I was a left-foot braker anyway, so it suited me down on the ground, and that's how I learned. Just no brakes. And he said, look, if you come in and the brake discs are warm, I'm going home. So that's how I like to do, like, 30 laps with no brakes. And he said, now have a look at the times. And the times were really good. So he said, you know, the last few tenths now, you start using the brakes, but only just a mild brush on them, you know. Keep rolling speed up. So, yeah, that's how I learn. I talk to, you know, some of the NASCAR drivers, Barry Graham particularly, and got a lot of insight. Bradley was, you know, very good there then. Yeah, they're all willing to, because if you had a crash, you took out four or five others, so no one wanted to crash.
Yeah, it's in their best interest for you to not crash because they're half a chance to get in it themselves. So,
And it wasn't about ability; it was more about the car. If you got the right setup on the day, doesn't matter who you were fast. You know, if the car scared you, you know, you didn't have the balls to go fast. You just couldn't. Yeah, anyone that, like, I think even Brock, I was there when Brock had a couple of goes, and you know, Charlie O'Brien, we all came from touring cars, and it was frightening. It was scary. Very, very fast.
Whole other world. It was really that era, JF, that helped you formally establish what was JFR. The Oscar racing, which led into the NASCAR racing, that was the real underpinnings of JFR as a business, I guess. Could you run it then as a full-time racing entity, or were you still doing other things to supplement it?
I still had the automotive shop, which my wife Alison was running then, and she was just doing the day-to-day stuff and trying to keep the customers out of the race shop, and because a lot of my clientele were racing enthusiasts, and I was working on like Jim McEwen's car, and you know, Beachy and Niavani, you know, like a lot of these motor racing teams would all hang around and talk shit while I'd service their cars. So I decided to move the shop, rented off through, then we ended up buying an old derelict factory and completely doing that up, you know, getting rid of the asbestos and painting floors. And so we all got stuck in as a, you know, a team to do that. And that started JFR. I always had JFA, but JFR pretty much started there. We epoxied the floor, you know, rolled in the new car. Then I heard about this huge amount of money for the road course event at Indy, you know, Gold Coast, 91, I think, when the Indy cars were coming out. And it was like 30 grand for 10 laps of racing. So we bought an old ex-Terry Labonte road course NASCAR, Oldsmobile. I think we paid like 15 grand for it. No motor, rolling. Leased an engine off Ian Thomas. Stuck it in, prepped it, water brakes, went up there, and it was the biggest field. They had the Yank, some American guy road course specialist, they had Grice, O'Brien, Richards, you know, there was a full field, all chasing the dough in NASCAR. And JF put it on the front row, mate. Front row Joe. Couldn't believe it. Thought, this is me, you know. This is my, you know, I'm finally driving with guys that I used to race in class race. He wouldn't give you the time of day. All of a sudden, they're all looking at the car and, oh, yeah, well done, mate. Yeah, fantastic. And all trying to see how the hell I did it. And it was just, that was my entry to JFR. You know, we were on the map. You know, didn't really care about Oscar. We were running that as well. That was super competitive. But that front row at Indy in NASCAR in a, you know, a cheap type car, had Ian Wally Walburn as my crew chief, you know, fiddling it and a bunch of other guys. But it started there, and that's when the link with Cummins, you know, Fisher Paykel, Bear Electrical, all that sort of started there, because in those days you had corporate credit cards. So before fringe benefits tax and all that shit, you know, people, you know, you'd go out for dinner and it was a race to throw your card down to pay the bill, you know. And that went through to motorsport. Oh, you know, can we buy you more tyres, you know, more cigarettes, you know, what do you need? What do you need? You know, it was like, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. And the link with Cummins appeared out of that. So they promised to, you know, pay for a couple of cars. I met Riley Gordon and he was sponsored by them at the time and had a good chat with him and how Cummins worked and the history of it and how you had to, you know, meet them and they get to know you and then you become part of the Cummins family, which I went over there and the CEO flew in on a Sunday and I had to go and buy a suit and sit down and do the deal and walked out of there with enough money to get two of the latest Chevrolet Monte Carlos built in Charlotte. And yeah, that was the start. We just signed Newlawn, oil company, on our NASCAR, and I had to relinquish that, which was unfortunate because they were a great family company that had supported me through Oscar and early NASCAR. And, you know, Cummins were really going to take over the whole deal. So A lot of those other ones had to take a bit of a back step. We still ran the signage, Better Electrical, Fisher and Paykel, and they were very happy for me to do it. So, you know, they were getting maximum exposure with the Oscars anyway. So
yeah,
that worked out good.
What was the standout result win highlight? I know in Oscar, Bradley Jones was obviously the bloke who it felt like he had a mortgage on the championship, but he didn't win all the races, even though he was winning titles. You won your fair share. Marshall Brewers, Steve Richards popped up there for a while. It was a pretty competitive field. But is there a particular win from that Oscar NASCAR era that you're most proud of or that springs to mind straight away?
Well, first of all, I never, ever had a NASCAR win. I actually won a race and got it taken off me.
That's right. A Thunderdome race.
No, Calder Park and on the
road
flat
course.
Track.
Ah.
I flogged them all and Bradley got the shits and drove in and crashed into the back of me in pit lane. And, you know, you usually want to fight with a helmet on. And he, you know, Bob Jane, we had an American crew chief, which we fly out for each round. That was part of the Cummins deal. Bob Ray Hilly, he was the one that won the first NASCAR race there in 88, the Valvoline car. He was...
with Neil Bonnet.
That was the dude. Yep, that was the dude. So we had him. So we'd, you know, we'd fly him out, put him up at the old Melbourne and he'd come to our shop day before with, you know, chalk and string and a quick setup and it was all about... He really wouldn't do anything until we got to the track. You know, it was all about... He said, mate, just... You know, you put the right tyre pressure in it and the right toe and you qualify it up the front and wait for the last 10 laps and, you know, we'll win some races. So it was a very easy-going dude. So, yeah, he that's what we did. But unfortunately, what I didn't know was that Bob Jane hated him. Straight out of blue from the first win, something about prize money. And then Bob Ray, when I arrived with the new Monte Carlo and I'm super fast in practice. I was two or three tenths faster than anybody. And in the shootout, you know, they're all pat me on the back for pole. And Max Dunsey, who had an issue in scrutineering, was the last to run. And out comes Max and blows my time away, which I thought was just impossible because, yeah, we were clearly faster than him all week and, you know, there was accusations of cheating and all sorts of stuff. And so Bob Ray Hilly wrote Bob Jane a letter, which was pretty shitty apparently. And I think after that and a few crosswords, it didn't look like I was ever going to win a race at Calder Park. I got to the lead and I was black flagged. So I'd run half a lap behind the field waiting for a yellow as promised. It wouldn't come out. You know, I'd get pulled in for potentially, you know, dropping fluids when there was none. It was just, in my mind, engineered, I was just not going to win a race in NASCAR there. So winning an Oscar, Adelaide, different track, suited me fine. Short races, won three in a row there. Had to push my way past Bradley. Bradley just had the act together. Him and Kim were just, you know, brilliant at what they did. They knew how to win races. The last 10 laps, that was what it was all about. We were flashy and fast, but at the end of the day, I'd wear all my shit out and I had nothing left. We'd tend to go and he'd win all the races. And I learned in the end that, you know, I had to just follow him around or play with him, get in his head, which we did. And I did that by going down to Larry Perkins and getting him to build me an engine. And they were brilliant engines. And it just put me immediately on the pace with Bradley and a couple of others that were quick. Les Small was building some rocket ship engines and part from HHDT. And yeah. So I was the only one with a Larry engine and it was up to the task. And we started, winning some races against Brad. And I had two opportunities to win the championship and me and Brad took each other out. And I don't say it in that order, but both opportunities were taken away, and that's probably my biggest regret, that he wasn't unbeatable out there. But yeah, the most serious dude about winning, you know, Kim and him appearing, that, you know, do or die. I had to win. I wasn't going to beat him in any mental game out there.
There you have it. That's part one of my chat with John Faulkner. Next week, part two, we talk some more about his Oscar and NASCAR days, and he opens up completely on his time in V8 Supercars as both a driver, a team owner, a franchise owner, and all the controversies and all the headaches that went on along the way. Plus, he tackles your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions and also the V8 Sleuth Top 10 Shootout. Don't forget, Father's Day's coming up pretty soon, couple of months' time. Jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. We've got some great specials, some great new books just released as well. Our new Adelaide 500 book is out. You can grab yourself a copy now from the website. Make sure you don't miss out. It's limited to just 1,200 copies. Of course, sign up to our newsletter at our v8sleuth.com.au website because you'll know about all the news that's going up on the website, all the latest offers in our store and everything in between. You can follow us on socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You know the drill by now. If you don't, get on board and you'll know the drill quickly. And as well, we love the feedback from the podcast. So keep your suggestions for upcoming guests flowing in, for questions, for general feedback. We love it. Make sure you subscribe to the pod too, because then you'll get the notification that you'll know exactly when the next episode has dropped. You don't have to go looking for it. You don't have to wait for it. It will be thrust right to your phone, pushed right to your device, and you'll know exactly when it's there for you to listen to. Anyway, that's us done. The V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. I'll talk to you every Tuesday for Repco Supercars Weekly and next week for part two with John Faulkner.